Welcome back to the Inside the Cross Pro Lacrosse Podcast. I am Kyle Devitt, the gear and lifestyle editor for Inside the Cross, and today I am joined by
Chris Rosenthal, Inside the Cross freelance contributor and pro lacrosse analyst.
And this is week double digits. That's what we're doing. There's too much of a split. We can't make a determination. We're just going to say we're past week 10. We're going to count the buys. This show is a recap of the previous weekend's action in Major League Lacrosse and Premier Lacrosse League. We do MLO first, and we swap weeks. Chris is going to take MLO first. It is my PLL week and his MLO week. Chris, tell me all about what happened in Major League Lacrosse this week.
All right, first things first, let's start with the Boston Cannons taking on the Atlanta Blaze. Kind of a big game. Boston was up at the top. It was a three-way split for first place heading into the weekend. So obviously they wanted to try to maintain that position and hope the other guys around them lost. We'll get to those other guys later, but spoiler alert, the Cannons could not pull it off. They end up losing to the Atlanta Blaze 14-13. Now, as far as how that went down, Blaze gave up the first goal, but then they went on a six-goal run. And some of the keys to that offense, first of all, Tommy Palacek basically handled the distributor duties from the attack position. You got to remember, Randy Stotts is still out nursing that lower body injury. But offensively, you know, they looked fine without him. You know, I'm definitely not going to claim they're better off without him, but they looked fine without him in this particular game. Like I said, Tommy Palacek looked great, making a bunch of crazy cross-field passes, getting everybody involved, and he liked the matchups or liked his angles, went to the goal himself. As far as the top side goes, while Palacek was down low, Mark Matthews handled the distribution duties from the midfield position. A lot of the time, they just had a short stick on him. You know, I mean, it was Zach Goodrich for most of that, and Zach Goodrich is obviously a talented defender, but there is just the size and wingspan issue that you're going to have with Matthews. You know, hindsight, maybe they thought they should have put a pole there. So now Matthews and Shane Jackson worked on the same side of the field, and Liam Banks, during the game, during one of his interviews, pointed out that, you know, apparently they're best friends. Just like Matthews and a bunch of the guys from this team have the box connections. So essentially, if you missed this game, what you missed was Mark Matthews posting up, running through the alley and running east-west and tossing no-look behind-the-back passes out to everybody. One-handed passes, too. He finished with three assists. Easily could have had five or six if not for some stellar play by Nick Morocco in goal, and, you know, just some unfortunate. I think some teammates still kind of getting used to the you have to be ready at any given moment because here comes a pass from Mark Matthews kind of situation. So very solid from him. He looks a lot more comfortable. Again, might be because of the box connection. It might be because of the, you know, pre-established friendships with the guys he's playing with, but he looked great. Shane Jackson, perhaps heard our discussion about why he was left off the list and responded with a giant middle finger in the form of four goals and an assist. He was also legit all over the place, no hesitation on his wing play. I mean, basically, the offense was solid and spread out throughout. A lot of key contributors there. Defense. Atlanta defense also strong, held the Cannons scoreless for the second quarter, and you know, obviously that helped as well. Let's see who else. Yeah, so that's basically what happened. Pretty close game throughout, though. Even though the Cannons gave up the six goal run, they ended up fighting their way back. You know, it's only one goal loss, so there's not too much I think they're going to be too worried about as far as, you know, sky is falling kind of situation there. Mark Cockerton had a pair of goals. Zed Williams had two goals and a two-pointer on the day. You know, so they were I suppose, going to be pretty satisfied with their performance. Rylan Reese back in the lineup.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's good to see him out there. He had a pretty solid game, too. So, you know, whatever it was, I guess he's either working through it or he's over it. So now, just one question for you. What do you think is going to happen with this Atlanta Blaze offense when Randy Stotts comes back in? And my question is largely rooted in the fact that they had Tommy Palasek shifted to midfield when they brought Brendan Sunday down and gave him more of a featured role in the attack position. But if you're going to do that again, then where does that leave Matthews? So, yeah, what is your vision or, you know, optimal suggestion of how they're going to handle these guys when Randy's back?
I think you just put Matthews at the point up high and hope that he's closest to the box to run off for the pole in a six on six, like half field situation. And then everyone else kind of does their thing. And you have Sunday, you know, you give Palasek a run from the wing. You let Brendan Sunday go down and invert on a shorter SSDM if he gets matched up against that. Or, you know, you just move the ball and let Shane Jackson be Shane Jackson and just stick balls cross cage and catch and finish. I think the key is to definitely have Matthews not in the crease, though. I think that's the problem that the Lizards had, where they were like, all right, we have all these guys kind of like they need the ball in their stick a lot. What do we do with Matthews? Let's turn Matthews into a finisher. And listen, like, he's a great finisher. But I think with this Blaze team, the key is to get everybody involved. And when this team has not done that, they have lost games. So I think that if they use him smartly and have him play almost like the point in an umbrella or a 3-3 kind of man up looking set where you can just throw a guy behind and it becomes a 3-2-1, I think he's optimal in that position. And then he can kind of like jog down to the wing, maybe see who switches onto him, and he gets his own clear out a couple times a game. You know, it's all about balance with that team. And also their defense. So if their defense plays well, like the Blaze, I feel like can beat anybody. If their offense plays well and their defense doesn't, they still aren't going to win. Like, hands down, they're not that good. They're good, but they're not that good. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, they're not like dominant tanks that are going to crush everybody.
Right. If they were, they would have put up 20 on Boston, and they didn't. Right. So I don't know. That's just my thoughts on that.
No, yeah, I think that's definitely something that is very, very likely to happen. I think the key to Matthews is, and I think this is something that Atlanta is very good at, you have to kind of trust him to do his thing. And I think it was kind of a fit in New York where they were like, oh, great, you know, you're here. We need you to do this. And I feel like maybe his vibe is a little bit different than, you know, we're going to put you in this spot right here. Kind of very, very like, you know, square peg round hole situation. But I think there's something with the Atlanta front office. Either it's, you know, Spencer Ford's decision making or Liam Banks' decision making. I feel like they seem to have a better grip on what to do with them. Again, you know, we'll see what happens when Randy Stotts comes back. But I think they might be okay. It might be a very, very frightening offense when they're all clicking together.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Let's roll on to the next one here. Let's go to the Chesapeake BayHawks taking on the Denver Outlaws. So this one was in Chesapeake. Where to start with this one? Let's start here. First place. That's where Chesapeake BayHawks are right now. They were in the traffic jam, but everybody else fell, and the BayHawks hung on. A dozen goals, not a ton, but, you know, if you're going to hold the Outlaws to 9, it'll get the job done every time. Similar to the Atlanta game, had a big run here. BayHawks gave up the first 2 goals of the game, but then they closed out the first half on a 9-0 run. It was kind of like the other day when we saw, it was a very similar situation actually to how we saw the Outlaws the other day, where it just seemed like shots just kept going in, you know? But in this situation, they continued to rely on Dylan Ward, and they kind of said, okay, you know, we're going to work our way through this. And so another sort of weird thing, if you look at the stats and the box score from this game, look at the faceoffs, there is a 1 in the first quarter for the Chesapeake BayHawks because Max Adler jumped on the first faceoff of the game, and then he didn't lose any more faceoffs.
Ever?
Nope. As of this recording, he has not lost a faceoff since.
Wow.
Yeah. very dominant performance. 23 to 24 on the faceoffs. I believe he had 9 ground balls. So that is a testament to not only his play, but knowing where to put the ball so his wings were able to pick him up as well. And, you know, the Bayhawks tried a lot. Kenny Massaw was not in the lineup, but they rolled out 3 different guys. You know, they had 2 poles trying it, you know, just trying to tie him up or, you know, create some sort of mess to counter this guy. But he had answers for everything. And that is a pretty amazing performance for him. But that being said, still 9 goals. You know, they had all of those opportunities and only converted it to 9 goals total. We've talked about this, I think, last week, and I think we maybe talked about it the week before. Let's talk about it a little bit now. Zach Currier, 0 goals, 1 assist. I'm going to say, okay, now it's an issue.
Yeah.
You know, last time I was definitely like, well, let's see. Little concerning, especially with Lanky Schlosser still injured. You know, he's there, but still not suiting up. And Brendan Cavanaugh out of the lineup for this game. Midfield production was not really there. You know, they had mentioned in a previous broadcast, I believe it was Tony Seaman, mentioning that Zach Currier was just playing angry, but not in the way that is sometimes viewed as an admirable trait. You know, sometimes people will be like, you know, oh, he's, you know, hulking up or beast mode or whatever, and, you know, he lowers his shoulder and, you know, freight trains somebody. It was really presented more of like he's mad at, you know, they listed a bunch of different entities he was mad at. You know, he's mad at the other team. He's mad at the refs. He's mad at the league. I thought it was of note that they mentioned the league itself, but I don't know what that's about. Just thought it was weird that it was mentioned. But something's going on there.
Wait, who was calling the game?
It was a Denver game. So the two fellows out there whose name just gave me right now.
Runs Warren? Yeah. Yep.
There you go. So, yeah, something's going on with Zach Currier. You know, we might get into a situation where it's, you know, the vicious cycle where he's, you know, playing a little off, and that's affecting his production, which is going to make him mad. You know, like we might have entered into that little loop right now where, you know, you're getting mad and therefore throwing your game off and therefore getting angry and so on and so on.
He's big mad.
Yeah. Legit big mad that we have not seen from Zach Currier so far. I do have to say this, though. They had some production from some guys we may not have seen previously. It's kind of a surprise. I don't know when this happened. Jack Jasinski, now a Denver Outlaw.
What?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Sick transactions page, MLO.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah. No clue. Ugh. Just watching the game. And they're like, oh, pass over to Jasinski. And I'm like, what? Because I could have sworn he was a Rattler. But he's not a Rattler anymore. Now he's an Outlaw. And I do have to say this. 2 things about Jack Jasinski. First of all, it's totally confusing because he's wearing number 50. And neither Kavanaugh is wearing number 50 because you have the one Kavanaugh wearing 5 and the one Kavanaugh who isn't there anymore. So you're going to look at him and be like, okay, well, that's probably a Kavanaugh because he plays like one.
Yeah.
And he wears a 50. So it's an optical illusion brain thing that's really weird to get used to. Also, I have to say he was probably their most dynamic offensive player. Like, especially for somebody who just showed up, you know, you might think, oh, there's a little bit of, you know, you don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to, you know, really make the big noise right away. No, he was feeling good. He was looking for his dodges, put 9 shots out there, led the team with a pair of goals. So assuming, you know, that wasn't an illusion and he really is on the Denver Outlaws, I would expect big things from him going forward. Kind of close it up here for the Outlaws. That's 3 losses in a row for them. And 2 of those 3, they haven't reached double digits. So, you know, I guess the question could be, are the Outlaws in serious trouble? Or the other question, are the Bayhawks really, really rounding into dominance at the ideal time this season? So let me go with the latter to you. Do you think the Bayhawks are the best team in the league? Or is the league so screwy that such a distinction is virtually pointless?
I think it's fair to say they're the best team in the league right now. And if I had to pick a hypothetical MLL champion for 2019, it would be the Bayhawks, for sure. And actually, editor-in-chief of Inside the Cross, Matt Kinnear, actually asked me, he's like, who are your picks for championship for both leagues? And the Bayhawks answer came way quicker than my PLL answer, but I'm going to tease that out for when we talk about PLL. But yeah, I also think that Denver's in trouble. So I think both of those theories are well and truly on their way to being, you know, proven out by the next couple games.
And let me just close up. Yeah, I agree with both of those. The Bayhawks, I thought, looked really, really solid. You know, and 12 goals is obviously not, you know, steamrolling these guys, but I thought they looked great on offense. Colin Heacock was very dominant down there, keeping him at attack, as we thought he certainly should be.
Good. That's what he should have been the whole time.
Absolutely. And, of course, I mean, I think this is probably redundant and unnecessary, but Lyle Thompson looked pretty good as well. I really like what they're doing. They're bringing Brendan Bomberry into a more prominent role, kind of on Lyle's side, because they're not a really heavy righty team.
They're a heavy lefty team, if anything, right?
Yeah. They're definitely more slanted towards the left side. But Bomberry and Thompson, you know, having worked together and being, you know, again, it's kind of like what I was saying with Matthews. You know, you get these guys on the same side, and you get these guys who are also very familiar with one another. Thompson and Bomberry are very familiar with one another. And so you'll have plays where Thompson will get the ball, and Bomberry just knows, okay, we're going to work a two-man game. And it, you can tell it kind of throws everyone off because it's not what they're doing on the right side. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like Heacock isn't necessarily running the same kind of two man game that Thompson and Bomberry run.
Right.
So it kind of it's something that can really make the defense's eyes go cross there. And I think as more and more games are under their belts together, and when they're both, if they're both kind of working through some lower leg stuff, but you know, like I think Lyle had a little bump a couple games ago, and Bomber was out for a few games. But the more experience I get, I think they get with one another in the field game and everything like that, it's just going to continue to result in big stuff for them. Now, let's get to the last one: New York Lizards and the Dallas Rattlers. Dallas Rattlers, 15 goals. New York Lizards, 11. So for the Rattlers offense here, that's 16 goals the previous game, 15 in this game. Three wins in a row for these Dallas Rattlers. What is going on here? Is this legitimacy? Can we crown some legitimacy at this point? What do you think?
I mean, listen, you can't argue against three wins in a row.
Yeah.
But I feel like you can argue against, like, their opponents taking them not as seriously, and also the Lizards being worse. And that's what I'm saying here. But I think that they played better in the game against Atlanta last week. I thought that was a huge win for them. And I think that when you start winning games, after you've lost a ton of them, you start to appreciate winning the games more. And I'm not saying you try harder, but maybe, just maybe, there's a little piece of you that's like, if I give everything I have, like, we'll win again. Because that's what we've done the last three games. And that's kind of like the mental space that you're in that situation, is you don't have a choice, right? You just have to impose your will. And I think for the Rattlers, now is an easier time than ever to impose their will. Do I think they have the least talented roster in the league? Maybe. I think top to bottom, it's hard to say that they don't, simply because they have to play veterans and rookies together on almost every single combo. So you're doing that on attack, you're doing that on midfield, you're doing that on, they have a ton of rookies on defense. So, and you got a rookie goaltender. Rookies can pan out and do well for long stretches. Every rookie hits a wall. I think Skinnone getting a start later on in the season and establishing himself really has helped him, because he learned a little bit in those games that he didn't play or saw spot action, and now he's the man. So I think that's one of the things that has really helped them, because now they can have a place to build from, even if it's from the back, that's fine. They just did, they couldn't build on anything. They had no success anywhere. Faceoffs, nope. Defense, nope. Craig Chick killed the guy and took the ball. Cool. Nope. You know, like they had Wasserman had a hat trick and 15 shots. You know, like these are the things that are coming that were the problem earlier, and now like guys are playing a little bit more inside themselves and playing up to their potential, and they're winning games. And then you look at the Lizards and the opposite is happening. You know, no one's really playing up to their potential. No one's getting enough touches. Everybody seems like they're miserable. I don't know. I think attitude has a lot to do with this 3-game win streak. And I think if they keep it going and they get a couple more victories and they beat some of the better teams, like, you know, if they can actually take down the Bayhawks, that's a sign to me that they've arrived. But 3 wins in a row, I think I chalk that up to guys figuring stuff out a little bit more. I mean, we didn't even know Jasinski wasn't on the team anymore. That's a dude that was taking 10 shots 4 games ago. You know, like maybe they figured out their turnaround and maybe they don't have to do it anymore. But I don't know. I can't sit here and be like the Dallas Rattlers are making the playoffs. Like, you can't make me say that. That's not going to happen. You still have to prove it, Rattlers. You still have to prove it. So it's my long-winded answer of saying no.
I think that's a fair evaluation, though. You know, I think it's perfectly fair to say that the jury is still out, you know, regarding the degree of legitimateness. Is that even the word?
Legitimacy.
Yeah. Was I saying legitimateness this whole time?
No, you just said it once.
Oh, okay.
And now twice, but it's fine. We're good.
All right, well, now I'm going to stick with it. But we'll see. Yeah, they're looking solid. I mean, 15 goals. The Lizards. So I'll say this about the Lizards. This is 3 wins in a row for Dallas. Thumbs up there. 3 losses in a row for New York. You know, you got to scale that a little bit as the weird sort of Bayhawks thing. I mean, I guess they lost to 2 teams 3 times, but, you know, you got to beat the team in front of you. So, you know, not my fault. I didn't love a little nitpicking here. The New York defense, they got caught lunging a lot. You know, you're throwing like the one-hand check, and then your man, you know, beats you on a split or something like that. And the reason I point that out is it's just because I don't see it all the time. You know, like, I don't love pointing out this sort of negative stuff all the time, because I just feel like, okay, you know, if you saw, you saw. You know, like, you know, what am I doing there? I'm not really helping. But I feel like there was too much of the lunging that the Rattlers were very, very eager to take advantage of.
Yeah.
And also a lot of situations where, I don't know if this was strategy or, you know, by virtue of footwork, where they kept getting caught up, getting hung in front of the goal with an attackman axe. And if there is one thing that the Rattlers love, I would say it is getting a defenseman hung like that. If you're going to give Bryce Wasserman space behind, I don't think there's anything he loves more than that. That is just a dream come true.
Spoiler,
for him.
He's going to do a speed dodge and shoot no matter what. Spoiler.
Right, that's kind of his thing.
Yes, that's what he does.
So I don't know why they kept, you know, falling in that trap or designing the defense that way. But I thought that was very surprising. They keep seeing that over and over again. As you mentioned, yeah, Wasserman did that quite a bit. And you know, he was largely successful. 3 goals, 2 assists on the day for him. Had a bunch of hat tricks in this one. Bradley Voigt, 4 goals and an assist from him. Cody Radowitz, 3 goals. Ryan McNamara, 3. You know, it was a lot of scoring. And, you know, kind of like what I mentioned about the Bayhawks game, super lopsided on the faceoffs. New York won 22 of 30. And, you know, the Rattlers were similar to Chesapeake, trying to throw out some different things. You know, they had a pull out there real early. But it just didn't matter. It didn't matter as far as their faceoff success, and it didn't matter as far as their offense producing. Couple notes from this one. Austin Kaut, first half in, second half out, and replaced by Brian Corrigan. If we're going to do a couple more things about the Lizards, couple sloppy turnovers. very questionable passes. And in this situation, the Rattlers were able to take advantage of them. You know, it's one thing if you make a bad pass and it goes out of bounds, and then you can both restart and set up, you know, a controlled situation. That's bad, but it's not the worst. But like, if you throw a pass blindly, you know, to the middle of the field and the Rattlers catch it and go score a goal, that is significantly worse. Rob Pinnell, I'll say, let's see here, finished with 2 goals, 2 assists on 12 shots. Here's the thing I want to talk about Rob for this one. So there's one part of the game where it looked like he was kind of joking around with one of his teammates. He had scored a goal, then he came over and did a thing where he was like adjusting his shoulder or something. They confirmed in the broadcast that it was some sort of joke or something. I was like, okay, great. Rob's having fun. Sends a pass across the field that, you know, kind of, it looks like it bounces off the plastic of a teammate's stick and goes out of bounds. And he is, Pinnell is legitimately jumping up and down in anger afterwards. You know, it's like a, you know, like you're ironing and you drop the iron on your toe or something like that. He is very unhappy. And so, you know, we kind of discussed the sort of connection between success and anger before with Courier. So I guess to kind of just carry it over to Rob Pinnell, do you think Rob Pinnell's body language matters, or you think it's magnified because he's the star? And I guess both can certainly be true.
I'm going to answer your question with a question, because that's the most infuriating thing I can think to do in this instance. Are we, like, the collective we, and also you and I, are we too hard on Rob to keep bringing up that he's not dropping 8 points a game? Is that, like, too much? Do we need to, like, settle down on it? Because I feel like every time we talk about a Lizards game, we have to talk about Pinnell. And, like, that's not necessarily something we have to do. What do you think?
Yeah. So I think... I think we are not necessarily too hard on him as far as productivity goes. Or we, I feel like we devote a fair amount of time to, you know, putting the magnifying glass on productivity. Just because, especially particularly in this game, I should mention Dylan Milloy was not available. So you basically, you know, you have Rob Pinnell and you have some people that he's trying to work with who, you know, maybe he's not used to working with. So I feel like the story in a game like this, as far as the Lizards go, is, oh, okay, and, you know, fair or not, I think it kind of falls in a situation where it's like, all right, well, is Rob going to be able to pull this off? You know, Brendan Kearns was joining him on that attack line with Justin Ray. And so, I mean, you know, I guess the story could be the Lizards as a whole, but I feel like it's just kind of the rent you pay when you're Rob Pinnell, you know what I mean? Like, if we're watching, like, a... Like an old Bulls game, and, you know, we talk about, you know, Steve Kerr and B.J. Armstrong or somebody like that, you know, I think people would be like, was Michael Jordan there? So, I mean, I feel like we're okay with that. I would question if it is too much of a deal. And, you know, I mean, I just asked the question in the first place. So am I making too much of a deal on whether or not Rob Pinnell looks happy on a field? You know, should that matter at all? I mean, when he's playing these games, he's at work, you know? Like,
yeah.
Do people care if you look happy when you're at work?
I think the counter to all this is, like, why are we doing this with Pinnell and we don't do it with Rabel and Harrison and some of the other older guys that are struggling in the PLL? And I think the answer to that, quite honestly, is that Pinnell is, like, the face. He's like the star they had, the superstar they have. It's him and Lyle. There's a reason that he and Lyle were chosen as All-Star Game captains. It's not because, like, they wanted to be All-Star Game captains. Right. You know what I mean? It's because they have the highest profile in the league. And with PLL, they've almost done a too good of a job of pumping up other guys so that they don't have to pump up Rabel and Harrison and maybe like a couple other guys that like aren't really playing like they did when they were in the MLL, shall we say, you know, yep. Stats, apparently hashtag stats do matter. But in this instance, I do feel a little bad because it feels like we're picking on Rob. Right. And we also like call him Rob, like we're friends with him. Like we're not, I'm sure like if Rob Pinnell saw me, he would just run through me like a wall. Like I was like a tiny paper wall. He wouldn't even care. But at the same time, I do think it's important to for him to do well in the context of Major League Lacrosse. And because he's not, it's easy to like, you know, project or transpose that kind of lack of star power on the field with everything else. You know, it's funny because that's the biggest difference between both the leagues is the PLL does such a good job of pushing guys that are doing well on the field, but also have good personalities. And then the MLL is just like, hey, look at all these guys that have all these great stats. And then the guys kind of handle their own promotion a lot of the time. And that's part of why the PLL got formed, by the way, is because guys were sick of that. They wanted more support from the league, support from their teams, and things like that. And certain teams in the MLL do a better job than other ones. I think the Cannons are very good at promoting their guys. I think the Bayhawks are good at promoting their guys when it's on their channel and they control the media. I don't think they care about anything anyone else says about their team except for them, you know, and you could say that about PLL too, but I think the main difference again is the spotlight is on Pinnell and Lyle in a way that it's not on anyone else in that league. So that's why we keep talking about Pinnell and like bringing him up, and he is a central figure to us because he's a central figure to the success of Major League Lacrosse, and his team is terrible. So how else do we just not talk about the Lizards? We can't do that. That's not what we do. So I think there's a little from column A, a little from column B here, but I don't know. Rattlers beating the Lizards is, if you've been watching games, not surprising. I know I talked to McNair, editor-in-chief at IL, and he's like, Kyle, the Lizards are 3-8? And I'm like, yeah, man. It's not doing good. We're not doing good over here, you know? But it is what it is. You know, it's surprising to a lot of people that are coming into the league later on that are just checking in. And I think that's where you need to have that importance of that guy who's like, I'm putting up 10 points a game. I'm awesome. And I don't really see that from Pinnell. I see it from Lyle, even though Lyle's like out of here playing hurt. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That's what you want. And that's why they're pushing him. And, you know, I think that they've cooled a little bit on pushing some of their other guys with their marketing. And it's fallen to the teams a lot more here in the second half of the season after the All-Star game. But, you know, they're probably too busy sending out thank you notes and T-shirts to people that went to the All-Star game. So it's fine.
Sure. I can understand that would take up a lot of time.
Should I tell that story?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, let's tell it. I didn't go to the All-Star game, and Chris was not available, the MLL All-Star game. So I wanted to have someone there that, you know, has experience with the pros and like would kind of produce a great recap and also have like kind of a flavor of its own. And so I reached out to Zach Babbo, who mostly does freelance photography for us. He works for a TV station now in Baltimore, but he used to work for IL for a number of years. And, you know, went to Newhouse at Syracuse. I know he knows how to write. I sent him the game. He did a great job, came back. And, you know, I thought that was kind of the end of it. And then last week, I get a DM from someone in the IL office. And they're like, hey, Kyle, there's a package for Zach that came to the office with a T-shirt and a handwritten thank you note. And they opened it because they didn't know what it was, because it was just addressed to him and he doesn't work there anymore. And they told me about it and I was like, oh, so the MLL sent a T-shirt to the freelancer that did one story for the All-Star game. And they were like, what does this mean? I'm like, I think you know what it means. And I think you know why you told me, and you think you know why I'm upset. So, and let me explain. Chris and I have combined for, 50 articles? 50?
Yeah, sounds,
let's say 50, right. 50 since the league started. All we've gotten is haranguing and email reminders to cover the league and to do things. And kind of like, they've helped a little. It's been a little contentious. I'm not going to lie to you. We've had some some back and forths that I didn't necessarily enjoy. And I just think it's really ironic that the league sends a thank you to a guy who did one thing because he was assigned to do it by me. And they knew that. And I'm a little, I'm not upset. I just think that it's like, it's like the, it's like both leagues not even interacting. Like, I don't, again, we're not here to like make sure people retweet our stuff. We're here to just make things that hopefully you enjoy and are entertaining, right? It's the same thing as both leagues basically just refusing to acknowledge the top 20 players article, even though a lot of people wanted to talk about the top 20 players article. They didn't want to. And that's their right. I'm not complaining. But there's a way that both leagues could have spun that positively for them. Like, very easily. And they both chose to do nothing. And it's promoting the players of your league in a way that, like, has no... There was no negativity in there, right? None.
No. If we didn't like the players, we would have put them on the list.
Hey, you know...
positive article.
You know what else doesn't have negative connotations? Any of the team of the weeks. Any of them.
That's true.
They're all celebrations of your best players every week. But it's okay. We're just going to keep our head down. We're going to keep going. We're going to keep not having t-shirts. It's fine. It's fine. But just know that now everyone else knows how petty you are and how petty I am for telling the story. We're both in the Petty Hall of Fame. Welcome. Here's your gold jacket. Let's have some fun. The seasons are ending. We're going to October here. Okay? Nerves are going to get frayed. We're going to lose some friends. That's fine. Let's go. And with that, I'm going to launch into the PLL recap for... It's their week 8. It's our week, like, 12. But week 8 in the PLL. First game, the Chaos 13, the Redwoods 10. Slow start here. Seemed like both teams were ready to play defense first in the 6 and worry about goals later in transition. But Sergio Saucedo got it started with an early hat trick for the Redwoods. But the scoring didn't really pick up until the second quarter for both teams, particularly the Chaos. And that's due, surprise, surprise, to the Chaos's excellent pace and tempo. I got a question for you, Chris.
Yes.
Why can't teams hang with the Chaos's pace? What do they do that separates them from other teams in the PLL? Because there is a clear delineation to their style of play from almost anyone else's.
So here is my theory on that very question. My theory is that the Chaos are simply about that life, whereas other teams must, I guess, like, must perpetrate as though they are about that life.
Right. They have to upshift.
Right. When competing against the Chaos. And eventually, I think they just blink. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're getting into. You know what you're going to have to do. But I just think, the Chaos mentality, the people they have up and down that field, the guy running the team, I think they just function at a level where they are like playing chicken, you know? And they're just like, okay, we're going to go and you're going to swerve first. And, you know, the opponents say, no, we're not. And then they say, okay, let's go. And yeah, then it's like they get, you know, they can see the white of their eyes and they're like, oh man, you guys really are crazy. And then they turn away. And I think the Chaos just keep their feet on the gas longer than other people are comfortable doing it.
Yeah. They're like the guy in a bar fight that, like, you pin him down, you're like ready to go at him. And he's like, yeah, we can go, man, but I'm going to take one of your eyes. Right. That's who the Chaos are. You know what I mean? Like, that's who those dudes are. Two, a one all the way down the roster. For me, it's that mentality, but it's also their ability to play lockdown defense in the 6 and kill chances for easy goals. Like, if you have to beat Chaos defenders one-on-one and go for a shot, because they send the slide from a guy behind you, they'll go cross crease, they'll slide down, they'll go upfield, wherever. It's actually like a really, it's a lot of fun to watch if you're a defensive nerd, but they also have these underrated defenders. Like, someone this week asked me if Jared Newman is a guy who just shoots twos or if he's a good defenseman. And I'm just kind of like, he's not playing in the PLL because he can shoot twos. He's actually really good. He was really good in college, but he played at Providence, so most of the people didn't see him. Hashtag New England bias. He was amazing. Honestly, I've been talking about him since he was like a junior there. Trust me. You know, he's a very good defender. The Chaos have clinched a playoff spot with this win. And this is where we go back to kind of the favorite talk. Are they the favorite to win it all, in your opinion, Chris? Because I think they are.
Yeah, I mean, I just really like their consistency. You know, you've had some other people kind of hanging around in that tier. But, like, you know, for example, their neighbors, you know, you want to talk about, like, the Whipsnakes. And we'll get to their, you know, gameplay later. But, I mean, I feel like it would be silly to say, you know, no, I'm going to put them ahead of the Chrome right now.
Yeah, it's I just feel like no team plays to the strengths of the PLL rules like the Chaos do. They dictate action in the middle of the field and in, like, kind of the dirty, grimy areas on the edge of the box better than any other team in the league. And then they have guys like Connor Fields with another amazing SportsCenter top 10 goal where he just looks like he's going up for a dunk and instead just puts it far pipe one-handed. You know, they got Fracaro in here just casually dropping two bombs in the middle of the offense after he caused a turnover and got a ground ball. You know, I think on the other side of the ball here, on the other side of the game, I think we have to ask the inverse question of the Redwoods. Are the Redwoods in trouble? Because they have a lot of guys that are not producing here in the second half of the season, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the question about the Redwoods is just going to be, are they going to be in trouble, like, relative to the other teams around them? You know, like, you know, it's kind of like there's a gate closing to get into the playoffs there. And, I mean, they might just kind of be able to duck under before the rest of the crowd sprints by them.
I mean, I'm just not, I was so unconvinced by their performance here. Honestly, like, just, it was an anemic offense. I just can't, aside from Salcedo going one-on-one and just streaking past dudes. I mean, Kavanaugh, you know, not fair. He rolled his ankle, didn't put up any points. Henningberg with 2-1 here. Garnsey with 3-1. I think they lean on Garnsey a lot. And like, he took 10 shots here. Like, Ryder Garnsey shouldn't be taking 10 shots when you have all these midfielders that are incredible. I mean, Perkovic 0-5. You know, Walters 0-5. Adams 0-3. You know, like, Kyle Harrison 0-2. Like, you eventually, these need to be goals. And some teams are hitting their stride, and I don't think the Redwoods are. So I think they need to kind of have a little moment in the mirror before they play their next contest. But let's move on to our second PLL game, and that is the Chrome 20. Whipsnakes 16. Chris, I posed this question, but I'm actually going to turn it into a statement. This was the first PLL game that was over after the first quarter. Chrome were up 10-4 after the first 12 minutes. I really was in shock, even though the Whipsnakes tied it up with four goals in a row and then got a six spot dropped on their necks to end the quarter. Play after play after play, it was an incredible run for the Chrome after being the league punching bag for the entire first half of the season. And Chris, you and I both know that I'm here for the Ned Crotty invert, because if that play isn't broke, you can't fix it. Hashtag Crotty Beard, Crotty season. 7 points here. His best performance of the year. The entire Whipsnakes attack line, except for Connor Kelly, who in this game, I'll answer the question, was an attackman, was held without a point. You cannot win in the PLL if your attack is not a threat. Forget, like, producing numbers. The Whips offense looked very rough outside of one-on-one dodges and rollbacks to poles for step-downs. Like, otherwise, we're just out here settling for shots, not looking for an extra pass. It was almost actually kind of like watching a body swap movie in the former lacrosse game, because The Whipsnakes played a lot like the Chrome did earlier in the season. They made all the mistakes the Chrome made in their losses. And on the other side, the Chrome were just slanging the ball all over the field like they were a box team. It was a great outing from them. Justin Gutterding balls out here for the Chrome with three goals, two assists, and now leads the PLL in points per game with 3.9. The only player I have ever seen impact the pro game as much as a primary, not only, primary off-ball player is Matt Poske. And Poske wasn't nearly as good of a passer or picker as Gutterding is. Gutterding, I mean, he also carries. He's like a tertiary carrier. He's up top, kind of in a couple of their sets. And I don't want to pigeon him as just an off-ball guy, but I think we need to have a moment to talk about how good Gutterding is. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I totally agree. Thing about Gutterding, he's one of these players that, and you know, you kind of think you'd see more of these just at this elite level, but you really don't. You really don't see these guys who are great wherever you need them to be great. And that's kind of what Justin Gutterding is, one of those guys. You know, you're talking about like the, you know, just kind of like a finisher sort of job. And, you know, there's one play in this particular game, you know, you saw Ned Crotty just in the midst of his absolutely going off, kind of feeding Gutterding, who was in the slot, had a super quick sort of catch and shoot. It wasn't even like a quick stick. He was too far away to, you know, just kind of redirect it. But he, you know, he probably had the ball in his stick for like a quarter of it, half of an eye blink or something nuts like that. And then, you know, of course, same situation. If things aren't working with like Jordan Wolf from behind, or if kind of, you know, Ned Crotty's, you know, invert isn't working or whatever, you can give it to him and then he'll just kind of take over that role as well. And there's not like a huge drop off when he adjusts to, you know, playing another role. And you don't really see that with that many guys.
Yeah, he's multifaceted. He can play in different parts of the field. Like, everybody has their favorite spots, but I feel like Gutterding doesn't have one. He just is good in a lot of places, and it's hard to tell. I mean, if anything, it's probably like 5-5, and that's like off ball as well. Like, he always sneaks in there. He'll set up like real wide and then just like streak in, and he's all somehow uncovered because he backdoors his defenseman. And he's got a goal. Just taking some time out. I called him Matt Poske 3.0. And Matt Poske 2.0 was just Gutterding in the MLL. And in the PLL, he's just gotten so much better. On the other side of the coin here, are we worried about Drenner and Rambo putting up goose eggs? Because I feel like we should be, especially since Rambo appeared to be benched for a long portion of this game. But I'm not necessarily worried about it because it's just one game. The Chrome had way more possession than the Whips, and I feel like those two guys in particular need to get a little rhythm to be at their top level of their game, and I think both will bounce back next week. But what did you see?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's kind of the courier rule. Even though he hasn't quite bounced back, I'm still going to implement that same sort of thing when it comes to the Whipsnakes attack line. Yeah, you know, Rambo being benched, I think there are probably a lot of reasons why it happened. You know, it looked like, it to me when I was watching the game, it looked like he wasn't really taking advantage of his angles to a degree we usually see Matt Rambo doing. You know, he generally, you know, like once he gets past goal line extended, you know, maybe takes an extra step or, you know, lowers his shoulder and kind of he dictates what's going to happen. And this one felt more like he was going with what they were willing to give him, but it wasn't really that much. You know, like the angles weren't there. Shot selection probably wasn't something that he would replicate if given another opportunity. I was a little surprised to see him just, you know, flat out not be out there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, if you feel like you got to shake things up, you know, you feel like you got to shake things up. And this was honestly a game where, yeah, you know, let's try a couple of things because, you know, they probably, you know, although it's just a 4-goal loss, watching it, you know, I know you felt the same way. It's like it looked real bad real early. So, you know, if you do need to try some things, this was probably a good game to do it.
Yeah, knowing Staggs and his coaching style, I'm going to have a hypothetical thought here. I can almost assure you that Rambo didn't do something on a ride or, like, didn't move. And Staggs was like, why didn't you do that? And Rambo didn't give him a good enough answer, and Stagg's like, cool, you're sitting.
Right.
That's just a guess. I don't know if that's true, but I'm speaking with experience of just Stagg's and not necessarily Rambo's tendencies either. I just think that that's the one thing you can't do with him. He will lose it on you if you don't ride and you don't play to a – and if you're stuck in the middle and you run off for anything, for a sub or anything, like, he will bury you. That's his whole philosophy of coaching pro lacrosse and, in many ways, NCAA as well. All right, let's move on to the third PLO game of the weekend. The Archers 15, the Atlas 11. Early on, Archers were all over the ball, getting good possessions, but they were also hitting posts and missing absolute bunnies on the doorstep. It got to the point where the Atlas scored their first goal to make it 2-1 when it should have been 5-0 Archers. And I thought the game would turn on that, and it did, but only briefly, because that turn did not hold as the Atlas got buried by a 6-1 run by the Archers that started in the second quarter and carried over into the third. Three of those six goals were from Marcus Holman, who is continuing his consistency in the PLL. How do you explain Marcus Holman to someone that has never watched lacrosse before, and what is your comp for him in another sport?
So I feel like if I was going to explain Marcus Holman, I feel like I've done this a few times. I would say he's kind of maybe like 6 to 8 different dog breeds put together.
Yeah.
Like he's okay. So he's definitely part bulldog. But then he's also kind of like a border collie or something. He's got like the cerebral aspect as well. There's definitely some chihuahua in there,
but also some golden retriever. I'm going to give you a little golden retriever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's just a lot. He's got a motor. I'd say, I don't know if I've ever seen a direct comparison, but I will say Westbrookian sort of motor, Westbrook-esque motor.
Okay.
I do think that Westbrook has like a motor not of this planet.
Yeah.
But so that's how I have to kind of taper and say like ESK or EN or something like that.
Yeah.
But I would say just like motor. No real kind of shyness when it comes to like initiating the physical contact or also, you know, just getting to open space as well. He's kind of like guttering in the sense that you can kind of peg him in for different places, you know, like he can initiate on the wing, you know, he can go to X, power play stuff, hangs out in the slot. The Atlas were super concerned about that. That power play setup where you get, you know, Schreiber up top and Holman's just always finds a way to be wide open. And, you know, Schreiber will do one of those null passes and drop it off to him. They had like a D midi just kind of draped on Holman. And then it ended up not working for another power play. And Holman ended up earning them on a goal for that. So that's how I would go about explaining Marcus Holman to someone who's never watched lacrosse before.
Yeah, it's interesting you went with Russell Westbrook. I would go with Kevin Durant just because of the different ways that he scores.
Yeah.
And not necessarily like when I think of Westbrook, I think of like just insane athleticism as well as the motor. And like, not that Holman's not athletic, but I think he's more athletic, like Kevin Durant's athletic, where like he can get to wherever he needs to go. But then again, you know, Holman had a cause turnover here, ran back on defense, picked up the ball and started to break. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe yours is more accurate. The other Marcus Holman playing for the other team, Eric Law, another great game here with 4 goals. I'm starting to worry about where Ryan Brown fits into the Atlas offense, though. I feel like he needs to be on the opposite side of the field from the Atlas initiators like Tinney and Busick, but he also can't be in the same spot as Eric Law. And I feel like kind of they fight for that spot a little bit sometimes, depending on where the dodge is coming from, particularly if the dodge is coming from the right and they're kind of sloughing off looking for that feed off of the double. I don't think you just sit Brownie in the crease. I think he's got to like kind of move around in like a 15 yard arc or a 12 yard arc in and out of the, you know, kind of right around where the 2-point line is to be effective. And with Law, I mean, Law's a ghost, but he gets a lot of his points by making the perfect drive from X when his defender is ball watching. And that's how he got, I think, at least two of his goals here. But I don't know. What do you think the solution is? Do you make Brown a high crease, low crease guy that moves up and down, kind of stringing, or do you see him fitting in another way? Because he's getting shots, but they're not good, and they're not running plays for him to get shots, and they should, because he's Ryan Brown, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I think I have to say, I think Ryan Brown is kind of, you know, he has had success, you know, to a degree right now, but I think he's also kind of a bit of a casualty when it comes to the shrinking of the field. You know, you're going to bump down all the midfielders, and especially in this sort of offense where, like, you know, you said you have Law. Law's kind of filling up that whole sort of space around the crease. So you're going to have, you know, the midfield kind of closer to the goal, and then you're going to have Brown, who's, I guess, has to kind of hang out between the arc and the crease. And kind of, I mean, if he's going off ball, though, it's like Law's not going to be, you know, carrying it from X. He's going to be, you know, either dodging from there, you know, like you said, when, like, the defender's back is turned or something like that. He's, like, off-ball dodging from X.
Right.
So it kind of handcuffs Brown's ability to, you know, kind of, you know, run a hook or run sort of fakes and things like that and curl off and get open. So he's kind of, you know, I mean, he's going to get his because, like you said, he's Ryan Brown, but he does at times seem kind of hamstrung by the confines of those around him. You know, you're going to have Connor Busick, you know, who can just, you know, do incredible things, you know, have Rabel on the other side. So it is kind of tricky to find an ideal situation for Brown. I think it's going to be a situation where it comes and goes, and then we'll just have times where he disappears for, you know, 5 minutes on end.
Yeah, what did you, on the other side, what did you think of Sankey making his debut as a midi for the Archers after the trade?
I really liked Joey Sankey as a midfielder, especially because they didn't put him in a situation where they're like, okay, you're a midi, so now just do alley dodges. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
he's a midfielder, but he's not John Rannikin, you know?
Yeah.
I think they knew what to do with him. I think they had maybe the extra week here where he didn't play gave them an opportunity to kind of assess where he would fit in especially well. So, I mean, I liked his work around the crease. You know, you can get him, if you get him on an invert, then it's like, oh, okay, all of a sudden you've got, you know, a UNC attackman playing just a short stick D midi.
Right.
You know, that's an advantageous situation. I mean, yeah, I thought he was really good without taking control of the ball. You know, he didn't demand it. And I think that is something that the Archer offense really needed, somebody who can contribute without actually needing the ball for long stints, and so you can still let, you know, guys like Schreiber do their thing.
Yeah, I thought, you know, I mean, he quote unquote played midi, but he played in attack spots, so I was just right. Kind of like, oh, all right, you're using him to kind of like create, you know, short stick mismatches, which, listen, he scored on one of them. It was a really bad short stick matchup. Tinney completely lost him at X, and he just came around and dunked it. One of my favorite moments of the game, which has been showcased on social media a couple times, was the brief Trevor Baptiste heel turn after he shoved Cuccinello into the net that started a melee. Did you see that highlight?
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed it because it was kind of like Baptiste's like, I didn't even do anything, but it, like, you watch the replay and he's like, yeah, I'm going to push you in. It's like, yeah, he thinks about it for a second. I really liked it. It endears me more than any, like, he has this kind of, like, I've met Baptiste before, and, like, he is, like, the nicest dude, and he's very humble, and he's, like, he'll shake your hand, and he'll look you in the eye, which is not what everybody does. So I'm giving him a lot of credit. I think that this whole, like, him as, like, a YouTube personality thing, I personally have not experienced that, but maybe that's because that's kind of the evolution of where we're going with these athletes in this league, and like, I understand that. But here I really saw, like, a little bit of that mischievousness that I enjoy in his game. Unfortunately, it did cost them a goal during that 6-1 run and wasn't inconsequential. But otherwise, he had a great game. This whole experience of this game with Archers and Atlas was the ultimate. You know, there's the games where you're like, no, 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 yes, and then it's a goal.
Right.
This game was the opposite, where it's like, yes, great pass, yes, crossfield pass. Oh, how do you hit the bar? How do you miss by 10 feet? You know, they had all these beautiful preamble to all these amazing plays and no finish. Like, we could have had a 25-24 classic on our hands. And I lament the loss of that to a certain level. But it tells me that both of these teams are doing so many of the little things right, but suffering from that final execution. And I think if you look back on some of their losses, that's where it comes. It's not necessarily awful or sloppy play or forcing things. It's not being able to execute after you do everything else beautifully. For example, would you be super surprised if the Archers won the PLL title or if the Atlas made it to the finals?
I will never be surprised if a Tom Schreiber-led team wins a championship. Conversely, I would be surprised if the Atlas made the finals, just because I feel like there are teams who are doing it with more consistency right now. I mean, that being said, I think we're just in a period of professional lacrosse where everything is bananas and there's nothing that can really be relied on for any sort of long period of time. But, you know, if I had to pick two teams to be the finals right now, the Atlas would not be there for me.
What a time to be alive. Chris, I see you have a note here. We have some breaking news for the podcast.
Breaking news for the podcast, courtesy of Twitter that I was just looking on. The Boston Cannons have traded Nate Solomon and a 2020 fourth round collegiate draft pick to the New York Lizards for Yale's old short stick DME, John Dangelis. Kyle, Solomon to the Lizards, Dangelis to Boston. Does either of that do anything for you?
I feel like they should have thrown in Ty too, and then they both would have had a second chance on a team that like would use them. So, and like the Cannons barely use Solomon anyway, so I think it's better for the Cannons because their attack is pretty set and Dangelis is not a bad player. I think that he's one of those guys that has to adjust to the pro game, and I saw his season debut when he was on the Lizards playing against the Cannons, and he's doing all the things he did at Yale, but they are almost inconsequential because riding is different, playing space is different, and the middle of the field is very different in the MLL. And playing that, you need to have a little bit more of a jump. Like, you can't let any balls go over your head because every goalie can throw the ball 60 yards. You know what I mean? Like, there's no, you can't take anything off of anything. And he's, by the way, Dangelis, great at sending picks, has an excellent shot. He's one of those kind of jack of all trades midfielders. I think maybe Boston can use him in a better space than the Lizards did, because the Lizards did not use him correctly at all. So best of luck to him there. And, you know, hopefully Nate Solomon gets a game. I mean, they're probably just trying to find out who can play with Rob. Sorry, Rob. I feel like this is like not the best Rob Pennell podcast for you guys, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like Nate Solomon's game. We haven't seen it during any sort of, you know, extended period of time at the pro level. But I think he is a super aggressive rider. I think he's one of those guys who doesn't need to have the ball a lot, who can just kind of, you know, work some off-ball stuff, crease things like that. And, you know, yeah, like I said, they're just kind of they got to figure out some combinations that work. So, I mean, and they got a fourth-round pick, which is I'm always surprised how they figure out about throwing picks in there. But I mean, yeah, it's not the end of the world, you know, and they get a fourth round pick and yeah, you know, see if Solomon can do something there.
Yeah. Our big question this week, when are we writing the PLL as Michael Bay movies article? And the answer is next week. We'll do that next week.
Oh, okay.
We're going to start it this week, but we're going to split it up pretty fair. And I'm pretty sure we're both going to fight over Armageddon. and which team, which team that is. I feel like it kind of sells itself, but I don't want to give it away. We're not giving anything away. Let's go on to our recommendation of the week before we close it all out. Chris, I'll let you go first.
All right. So last week I was talking about a TV show that I watched, but I'd only watched half of it, and so I didn't want to recommend it in case it sucked. The second half did not suck, and the television show was a two-part, I guess, documentary on HBO. I don't even know if you call it a documentary. It's a true-ish, true crime-ish sort of thing called Who Killed Garrett Phillips? If you are a fan of the sort of Law and Order genre, but not the TV show Law and Order, this is the kind of thing that you might find interesting, this, the true crime sort of stuff. But I do have to say, and, you know, take this as a good thing or a bad thing, whatever you're into, it's not about, like, the crime itself so much. So, you know, if you're looking for, like, gory stuff that happened to some guy, then that's not what this is. This is really more about, you know, once there's a suspect, how do the courts operate? How do the lawyers operate? Like, you know, it's a small town in upstate New York. So it's like, you know, how does the town operate? Are they, you know, automatically on this guy's side or automatically on that guy's side? And, you know, how does that influence collecting evidence and blah, 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 blah. I really think that sort of thing is interesting. You know, I get into the true crime stuff from time to time. So I thought both parts were interesting and ton of plot twists. Like, you're watching it and you're like, oh, okay, this is obviously what happened. And then something else pops up and you're like, okay, now I have no idea. A ton of those keeps you interested. And like I said, it's only two parts. I'm going to do second recommendation because it is mid-August. So this is about the time I got to do it. Summer Inventories. This is my recommendation. Since the summer is coming to a dizzying close, take a look around, think about the stuff that you wanted to do during the summer and haven't gotten to do yet, and jot it down mentally or on some paper or whatever, and then actually get to pulling it off. Doesn't have to be anything crazy. You don't have to, like, drive to the Grand Canyon or go bungee jumping in Hawaii. It might be too late for you if those were your plans. But, like, I know there's, like, a restaurant by my office that serves, like, a killer pulled pork barbecue sandwich only during the summer, and I haven't been yet. And if I don't go in the next, like, 2 weeks, I'm going to feel like a real jerk. So stuff like that. Small things, figure out what you're trying to do with your summer and make the most of it, because, you know, we're going to look up and it's going to be fall. And there's still going to be pro lacrosse because it's going to October, but it's going to be fall nevertheless. So those are my recommendations.
Karen, buy that kayak. Come on. It's right there on Facebook Marketplace. You've been looking at it for 2 weeks. Just buy it. All right. So my recommendation of the week is definitely – I feel like I can't have the same one as last week where I said go to Lake Placid, so I'm going to say go to Lake Saranac or Saranac Lake. People from that area, I've made that mistake several times, and now I do it on purpose because I know it really upsets people from that area. It's Saranac Lake, but I call it Lake Saranac a lot. My sister-in-law is from an area around there, and she loses her mind every time I call it Lake Saranac. But I stayed in Saranac Lake for Placid. It's my fifth or sixth year in a row doing that. I just think I'm out on the hustle and bustle of downtown. Although, shout to the couple people I saw downtown while we were there after games. Saranac Lake is an amazing little kind of old mill town mixed with, like, weird hipsterism mixed with hick culture. It's kind of like, for me, it's like being home, but away from home. So I would definitely recommend checking that place out if you're in upstate New York. Great time at the Lake Placid tournament, as usual. And as usual, I am injured afterwards. So, but depending on where you hear this, I'll be seeing a doctor for my possibly torn calf and maybe dislocated wrist. We don't know. We're going to figure it out. But thanks to all the trainers that helped me keep playing while I was there, and the people that convinced me to play for other teams. I kind of hate you right now, but we had fun. So that's it for the Pro Lacrosse podcast for this double digit week. Make sure that you follow Chris and I on Twitter. Chris, what's your Twitter?
At ChrisRosie22.
And you can follow me at the Kyle Devitt. Thanks for tuning in. Everyone stay petty. Also, shout out to our producer, Dane Ahern. This is the last podcast that he will produce for us. We want to thank him for all of his tireless work of not putting in our shout outs or our audio clips. But hey, at least it got uploaded, and best of luck in your future endeavors.